I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Asher Lopatin, president of Yeshivat Hovavei Torah Rabbinical School and the leading proponent of Open Orthodoxy. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We're in the end of the year season, a time of holiday overload in America. Oddly, even though Hanukkah was over back on December 5th, lots of people continue to wish me Happy Hanukkah. And I'm tempted to respond, and Happy Thanksgiving to you. But instead, I always say, Happy Holidays. After all, joyful holidays should be fun and celebrated as such by those to whom they apply. So, free of competition from Hanukkah this time around, all the media focus this year falls inevitably on the overwhelmingly popular festival of Kwanzaa. Christmas, which is the theoretical birthday of Jesus, celebrated as such since between 150 and 300 years after his death. No one actually knows the real date of Jesus' birth, and the New Testament isn't very specific even about the month, which likely was sometime in the fall, if it was tax time in Israel in the first century. But what the heck? It's the time of year that Western civilization has been focused on for a long time. We are now approaching the shortest days of the year, the winter solstice, a time when the sun is farthest from us and when many cultures observe winter holidays. And while some Christians have tried to limit Christmas celebrations, under Cromwell, the Puritan English Parliament even banned Christmas celebrations for a few years, it is kind of popular today in America. But it's not necessarily popular with everyone, including some Christians. I mean, there's a great deal of pressure on folks during the holidays, especially this one. While we Jews have lots of festivals to celebrate, and some of them, like Hanukkah, are actually quite long, American Christians are mostly limited to Easter and Christmas. And Christmas is by far the bigger deal in popular culture, if not religion. So, to commiserate with our Christian friends, some of my best friends are Christians, during this time when there is so much pressure to make this one the best holiday ever, I must prefer some unasked-for advice. As a member of a people that has way too many holidays, it's always best to remember there's going to be another one coming along sooner or later, and that the point of any festival is to observe its real meaning. Not overdo the rituals of celebration or commercialization that our own culture often buries the holiday under. So, have a happy holiday. Just don't try to make it a perfect one. To play us in on this theme of happiness, here's a very fun version of the prayer Ashrei, based mostly on Psalm 145, Ashrei Yoshvei Veitecha, Happy are those who dwell in your house, Lord, as sung by the Yeshiva Boys Choir.
Ashrei Yoshvei Veitecha.
was Ashrei, as sung by the Yeshiva Boys Choir. On a serious note this morning, yesterday was the first anniversary of the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, and that terrible tragedy reminds us that as yet we have still done nothing to address the plague of gun violence in this great country. The same solutions that were proposed a year ago in the aftermath of that horror of grade school children and teachers slaughtered in their classrooms are still right. More extensive background checks, a limit on the capacity of magazines, a ban on civilian possession of assault rifles, all these should be enacted. All it takes is political will and common sense. Failing to do this defames the memory of those innocent children and their brave teachers and administrators. In more upbeat news, we have a terrific and very interesting guest this morning on Too Jewish. Rabbi Asher Lopatin is the president of Yeshiva Chovavei Torah Rabbinical Seminary and the most important advocate of open orthodoxy. Find out what it means to be fully orthodox and very welcoming and embracing when we return here on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics. And they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. He's Rabbi Asher Lopatin, the president of Yeshivat Chovavei Torah Rabbinical School, the leading modern and open Orthodox rabbinical school in America and New York. Previously, he was the spiritual leader of Anshei Shalom B'nai Israel congregation in Chicago, which he grew into a dynamic modern Orthodox congregation. He is widely known for his commitment to fostering and promoting an inclusive view of Orthodoxy, often called open Orthodoxy. By the way, among Rabbi Lopatin's congregants in Chicago is Rahm Emanuel. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thanks so much. It's great to be on the show.
Delighted to have you. Tell us a little bit about what it's like to have succeeded Avi Weiss at Yeshivat Chovavei Torah.
Wow, very good question. He has actually made it a pleasure. He is there to mentor me. We meet regularly every week, and I see him even during the week at other times. He's really made me feel empowered. And, you know, he's the type of person that, yes, has a very strong personality, but at the same time, he really wants to make sure that this is a real succession. So he is very careful to, you know, put me in the front and center when, you know, I think he would do much better. But it's really, because of him, it's been an exciting transition. And I do feel empowered. And what Rav Avi says is it's really about the students. It's about the students that are in the yeshiva and those that are out that are really making a difference, are 86 graduates. So, you know, he's always emphasized that it's not about him. It's not even about the faculty or the amazing staff that we have, but it's really about the students.
Tommy Dim Harbe, can you, in a brief manner, explain for our audience what open orthodoxy is or means?
Yes, so open orthodoxy is really just like any other orthodoxy, with an emphasis on, first of all, being open to new ideas, new interpretations, discussions, a really non-judgmental attitude towards any kind of you know, honest and open, sincere discussion. And then also the idea is that opening up the box and getting the students of Torah outside into the world, not keeping people closed into any certain communities or an establishment or a set area, but really getting them out and that kind of openness. So it's both opening up our hearts and minds to new understandings of Torah, all based on tradition and our Masoret and the divine Torah that we have, and then really opening up these, unleashing these forces of Torah into the world to have an impact on the world and to really actually have a symbiotic, a mutually beneficial relationship when these students are in different environments, in hospitals, on college campuses, in synagogues in Kenya and Finland and New Orleans. So that's sort of the idea of this openness, both open from the outside and open to the outside.
I want to thank Asher Lipotin for a great beginning. We'll have an opportunity to hear more from him about Open Orthodoxy and some of the controversies swirling around it when we come back on Too Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road Office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world is certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio@yahoo.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio. Or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. And oh, by the way, we have a new email address. In addition to toojewishradio@yahoo.com, you can send us an email at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. Take your pick. As we get closer to that great end-of-the-year non-Jewish festival, Kwanzaa? New Year's? It's time for our favorite Jewish parody of Christmas songs. This year, we have a top three to play for you, not all exactly parodies. To start us off, there's a British song on this theme called This Jewish Christmas by Daniel Kaner.
This Jewish Christmas, I promised myself not to get sucked into all that. The hiding and hoping, the bribing, the stealth, diving, the ducking, and all that. I know that it's pagan and Celtic, commercial and crass, and the story has quite a lot of Jewish bits. But I feel like a schlemiel at this midnight mass, or like Dracula when he sees a crucifix. It's not in my genes, these nativity scenes. They're the stuff of bad dreams. This Jewish Christmas.
That was some of Daniel Kaner's This Jewish Christmas. The original goes on for 6 minutes, worth a listen online. And most years, there's also holiday confusion as to whether to observe Hanukkah or Christmas. While this year it's not so much true, our second entrant in the Jewish Christmas Songs parody competition reflects that. It's called I'm Keeping Kosher for Christmas.
My father was a Catholic, my mother was a Jew. That's why I'm so confused, wouldn't you be too? With the holidays approaching, oh, which one will it be? Eight lit menorah candles or a lit up Christmas tree? Oy. We keep two sets of dishes, one for dairy, one for meat. My mother makes enough brisket to feed a naval fleet. I love potato latkes, that's part of who I am. But I'm feeling kind of guilty about that Christmas ham. So I think I'm keeping kosher for Christmas, just because I don't know what to do. Should I celebrate the birth of baby Jesus, or Hanukkah since Jesus was a Jew? We play dreidel, dreidel, dreidel around the Christmas tree. My father's side sang carols while my mother's side kvetched. At midnight when most people open presents by the tree, we take our time, but 8 days is a little slow for me.
But even with these new entrants, our funniest end-of-the-year routine remains a takeoff on a Mariah Carey Christmas song, All I Want for Christmas Is You. This one's now a perennial, and it captures the spirit of show business so prevalent at this time of year.
I won't ask for much this Christmas. I don't even wish for snow. Just want a Jew who runs show business. Spielberg, Stiller, Ari Gold. I will make a list and send it of my choices for singing. Signed by the Zebra and Jon Stewart.
That was, of course, All I Want for Christmas Is Jews. Now, I'm not saying there's any truth to the rumor that we Jews run the world. We don't. But we do have Hollywood. Anyway, our winner is, well, all of us, who have the happy opportunity to celebrate our Jewish identity in this wonderfully open and religiously free country with its preposterously talented popular culture. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, J-E-T-C-O, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. The state of Arizona allows its taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations, who then provide scholarships for kids from kindergarten through 12th grade to attend qualified private schools. JETCO helps provide a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get a a 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Tax credit's not a deduction. Your taxes are reduced by the amount you give. Join over 750 supporters last year who donated money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. There's an additional tax credit now, the Switcher credit, which increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,031 for single filers, $2,062 for married couples filing jointly. When we are fighting every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, we should all take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to help foster a Jewish identity for our community's children. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive the financial aid they need to receive a good Jewish education. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, call 520-647-8442, again 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of education.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So Iran's been in the news quite a bit, making deals. Israel not sure they're going to stick to the deals. John Kerry negotiating all over the place. A very hot topic now.
Right. Well, it's funny that you should mention that, because just last night, I was publicly put on the spot by a friend who's an army officer. She's about to turn 40. We're discussing travel plans for her birthday, and suddenly she posts on Facebook a response to an article which was apparently published in Foreign Affairs that suggests the possibility of an alliance between Israel and Saudi Arabia for the purpose of attacking Iran and using Israeli technology and pilots with Saudi planes, because both air forces have F-15 supplied by the U.S., striking at Iran from bases in Saudi Arabia avoids the necessity of mid-air refueling, et cetera, et cetera. It's much closer. And basically, the article posited the likelihood, or at least the strong possibility, that for one limited purpose, the Israelis and the Saudis would find common ground and would band together to prevent Iran from acquiring full nuclear capacity. Since neither country is satisfied that the agreement worked out by Kerry and company will be sufficient. So since my friend put me on the spot publicly, I felt like I had to respond. And my response was something I'm happy to share with your listeners, which is, I think it's highly unlikely that even for a short time, limited purpose, which is to stymie and to basically decapitate in a way a common enemy, that the Saudis would ever overtly form any kind of an alliance or common cause with Israel. Covertly, who knows what they might do? They might give Israeli jets permission to land and refuel on the ground. They might do something that wasn't public, but a public joint operation carried out by Israelis and Saudis together seems to me all but impossible.
Yeah, it's sounds like a brilliant piece, and maybe just after the Messiah comes, the Saudis will do something publicly with Israel. I just can't imagine the location of Mecca and Medina and that regime cooperating in any overt way with Israel, even though they're terrified of Iran, too.
Well, it's not only that they're terrified. They, they're Sunnis, the Iranians are Shiites, they're exporting Shiism and terrorism. Saudis don't like terrorism. Saudis don't like the idea of a popular revolution, which is what happened in Iran. There's a lot about Iran that scares the Saudis other than just nuclear capacity. And there's also the traditional rivalry, as we've talked about before on this show, among Turks, Arabs and Persians for leadership in the Islamic world. First few centuries, it was clearly Arabs. Then for a while, it was Persians. Then for many, many centuries, it was the Ottoman Turks. And now, in some ways, the Turks are the leaders. In other ways, the Arabs definitely are. But the Persians are always struggling for their what they see as their rightful leadership role in the Islamic world.
Fascinating. Well, we will certainly see. It's an interesting time. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A rabbi is hit by a car while crossing the street outside the Catholic cathedral. He's badly injured and barely clinging to life. From his office, the bishop hears the screeching of tires, the impact of the accident, races outside, kneels down to the stricken rabbi, who looks to be fading fast, and asks the man, "Sir, do you believe in the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost?" The rabbi lifts his head to an onlooker and says, "I'm lying here dying, and this schmuck is asking me riddles?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well, and don't get hit by a car. And now a word of Torah. This week we begin reading Exodus, the second book of the Torah, with the great Torah portion of Shemot. I admit to being a little biased here. This was my own bar mitzvah Torah portion, but certainly Shemot is one of the great sections of Torah. It begins with a kind of coda on Genesis, recounting how the first family of Bereishit, made up of Jacob and his many sons and their descendants, all moved down to Egypt, where Joseph is the effective ruler of the country. They settle in Goshen in the north of Egypt and flourish there. And then the fateful events that set the future of our people begin. Joseph and his generation all pass away. A new dynasty takes over in Egypt, which doesn't remember Joseph and his contributions. The Israelites are viewed differently. As they grow in number and wealth, the new pharaoh worries. These immigrants could be a fifth column in the event of an invasion. They speak a different language, worship a different god. Maybe their hair is curlier, their nose is larger, their skin a bit darker. They have funny accents. They look like trouble. Isn't it interesting how history is a way of repeating itself? How the same negative stereotypes and wicked ways of looking at immigrants recur? And so the Egyptians enslave the Israelites, putting them to work as unpaid slave labor, building store cities, not pyramids, by the way, for the royal government. They set up overseers called taskmasters, establish work quotas, push them harder and harder, essentially try to work them to death. When that fails, these Hebrews are tougher than the Egyptians expect. They decide to simply kill all the male babies, eliminating the whole masculine population in one generation. But the Jews are too crafty for their oppressors. In the tribe of Levi, later to be the priestly tribe, a woman hides her newborn boy baby until his cries are too loud to be stifled. She puts him into a tiny ark, a new Noah, and lets him sail in the Nile River. And when the Pharaoh's daughter pulls him from the river and names him Moses, a remarkable personal story is truly begun. Shemot tells us of the early life and adolescence of Moses, his instinctive outrage at injustice, his hot temper, his exile to the Sinai. It shows him mature, marry, father children in the desert. And then it takes him through the dramatic narrative of the burning bush, an encounter with the commanding God that will bring him back into the crucible of history and lead him to become the greatest liberator the world has ever known. Finally, it returns him to Egypt to meet his brother Aaron and shape his destiny and ours. There's almost too much in this portion to grasp, encapsulating as it does so many of the formative tales of our people's religious history. But most importantly, unlike so many other traditions' hero stories, Exodus doesn't make Moses into a god or even a perfect paragon. He is just a man, a great, flawed man, born into conflict not of his own making, rising to that greatness only through trial and error, learning both how to follow God and how to lead people towards justice and freedom. It's a great story, of course, but more than that, it's a powerful lesson. Moses became the model for every truly great leader thereafter, because of this very humanness. His ability to empathize with the suffering of the downtrodden, to utilize the power of righteousness to accomplish everything. May we come to understand that we can accomplish great things too, if we choose, in spite of our own imperfections and limitations, our human weaknesses, so long as we fight for justice, freedom, and truth. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Asher Lopatin of the Modern Orthodox Yeshiva Chovavei Torah, will explain what open orthodoxy is and discuss what it's like to succeed, the first rabbi in Jewish history to ever ordain a woman. Find out when we return on To Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
There were some sparks at the Saban Forum last week between the heads of state and foreign affairs of the United States and Israel. The Saban Forum is an annual dialogue between American and Israeli leaders from across the political and social spectrum, organized by the Saban Center for Middle East Policy, which is part of the Brookings Institution. I'll tell you more about the verbal dueling over the progress or lack of same in negotiations with the Palestinians and about Iran between President Barack Obama, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, and Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman. Well, I'll tell you about it in a little bit. But first, how did this little project, the top couple of people involved in foreign relations for Israel and America, coming together for days to discuss where things are right now at the Brookings Institution in early December each year anyway? Well, Chaim Saban, the money behind the Saban Center and this project, is quite an interesting guy. Born in Alexandria, Egypt, his family moved to Israel, where he grew up and later played bass in a rock band. He moved on to become a music producer, composer, agent, and eventually a media mogul. Among other highly successful projects, Saban introduced the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers to America. Thank you very much. Made a series of hit movies based on Marvel Comics characters, and later, in partnership with Rupert Murdoch and Fox, created family TV channels, eventually sold the whole thing for enough money to become a multi-billionaire, and moved into finance. Saban is now a major political contributor, a friend of the Clintons, and a mover and shaker in politics, where he defines his interest as Israel first and foremost. Anyway, he set up this Saban Forum, now in its 10th year, and this one was particularly noteworthy for the sparks that flew. Avigdor Lieberman, the newly reinstated Israeli foreign minister, called any final settlement deal with the Palestinians mission impossible, while Israeli cabinet minister Sylvan Shalom told reporters that reaching an agreement with the Palestinians within the 6 months still left under the American time frame was detached from reality. Well, last week, Kerry and his State Department team had presented the Israelis with a detailed plan prepared by retired General John Allen that aimed to address all security concerns Israel might have about the creation of a Palestinian state in the West Bank, which is the ultimate goal of these negotiations. Never before has the U.S. conducted such an in-depth analysis of Israel's security requirements, John Kerry told the Saban Forum, adding that Allen's plan will make sure that the border on the Jordan River will be as strong as any in the world. But Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu seemed to minimize the effort's importance and shifted his concern to a different focus. The core of the conflict has never been borders and settlements, Netanyahu said. It's about one thing, the persistent refusal to accept the Jewish state in any border. Netanyahu has begun to raise this issue of Palestinian acceptance of Israel as a specifically Jewish state, not just a diplomatically recognized or accepted country. This didn't used to be a precondition for Israel's peace agreements, not with Egypt and not with Jordan, but it is now playing a greater role in Israeli negotiations. Meanwhile, the American and Israelis' differences on Iran were clearer still. President Obama took issue with every Israeli objection to the way discussions with Iran are being held, and with Israel's opposition to the interim agreement recently reached with Iran on its contested nuclear development. Both Israel and the U.S. say they seek to prevent the prospect that Iran's program will allow it to develop nuclear weapons. Many observers, of course, think Iran aims to do exactly that, despite all its denials. But the differences in tactics between the U.S. and Israel were pretty sharp. Obama rejected Israel's demand that sanctions be increased while negotiations for a final agreement are taking place. The idea that Iran would cave if sanctions were ratcheted up, he said, does not reflect an honest understanding of the Iranian people or the Iranian regime. The president also flatly rejected Israel's demand that Iran, under a final agreement, completely give up all uranium enrichment, describing it as an unrealistic expectation. One can envision an ideal world in which Iran would say, "We'll destroy every element and facility, you name it, it's all gone," Obama said. "I can also envision a world in which Congress passed every one of my bills." The audience laughed. Obama went on to state that the U.S. could accept low-level enrichment under strict limitations and monitoring as part of a final agreement. "I hope that the people of Israel have an opportunity to listen, think, and to understand our rationale and our goals, because at the end of the day, we have the same goal, which is to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon," said Ambassador Dan Shapiro. Israeli officials were unmoved. They maintained that their government's firm rejection of the interim agreement on Iran and its tough stance on a final deal were paying off. "It is strengthening America's hand," said Likud member of Knesset Tsachi Hanegbi. Intelligence Minister Yuval Steinitz added, "We cannot remain silent and hide disagreements when it comes to our existence." Saban, the conference's host and a major donor to the Democratic Party in the U.S., told Israeli TV that bringing the president to speak to an Israeli audience was his personal highlight. "It's very important for the relationship to have the president speak to the Israelis," Saban said. "And for me, bringing the American president closer to the people of Israel is a life goal." Jeffrey Goldberg, the columnist for The Atlantic, who participated in the Saban Forum, marveled at Saban's ability to draw this stellar retinue of top leaders from the two sides to his conference. "Everybody wants to be king of the Jews, but I think Saban might be the king of the Jews," Goldberg said. "When he picks up the phone, people answer and they do him favors." Certainly a very interesting event. In South Africa, the Jewish community paid an emotional tribute to Nelson Mandela, a man they dubbed the Rainbow Nation's Joseph for overcoming apartheid to build a future based on reconciliation. Speaking to an overflow crowd of several thousand people in a Johannesburg suburb, Chief Rabbi Warren Goldstein recounted the biblical story of Joseph, who overcame years of imprisonment to lead his nation. Goldstein said the story, which concluded in last week's Torah portion, mirrors the tale of Mandela, who famously set aside 27 years of imprisonment on Robben Island to reach out to all South Africans. "In Nelson Mandela, we found our own Joseph," Rabbi Goldstein said. "He was able to put aside all the bitterness from those long years of imprisonment and rebuild this country." He noted that most of South Africa's 70,000 Jews immigrated from Eastern Europe in the face of pogroms and anti-Semitism, making the freedom and democracy of the new Rainbow Nation that much more precious to them. "These are blessings that our history as Jews tells us to never take for granted," he said. Many South African Jews worked to help Mandela on his long road to freedom and eventual leadership of the nation. Rabbi Goldstein read a list of Jewish South Africans who played prominent roles in the freedom struggle, including Bram Fischer, the lawyer who defended Mandela during his infamous treason trial, and Joe Slovo, the famed leader of the African National Congress and South African Communist Party. Former South African President Thabo Mbeki also praised Jews for standing with Mandela in the struggle against apartheid. The soft-spoken leader, wearing a black yarmulke, warned the crowd that Mandela's mission will not be complete until South Africa achieves more economic and social equality. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World.
Our brothers,
Welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Rabbi Asher Lopatin. He's the president of Yeshivat Chovevei Torah Rabbinical School, the leading modern and open Orthodox rabbinical school in America in Riverdale, New York. Previously, he was a spiritual leader and kind of the founder, really, of Anshei Shalom B'nai Israel congregation in Chicago, which he grew into a dynamic Orthodox community. He is maybe now the leading rising figure in open Orthodoxy. What does it mean to be considered on the liberal wing of the Orthodox movement when you're dedicated to Torah, Halacha? How does that feel? Is that a label or a title you're comfortable with?
Thank you. First of all, I didn't, the synagogue, you're so kind. I did grow it, thank God, tremendously. It's wonderful. And not just me, but of course my wife, Rachel, and the whole entire shul. It was great chemistry. But it was an old shul, over 100 years old. And so maybe revitalize is a good term.
Revitalize is better than founder. I apologize.
No problem. No apology needed. The other thing is, I get a little queasy because about the first of all, liberal, that's wonderful. I have no problems with a person who is liberal. I have no problems with a liberal portion of cake if I am given that for dessert. But on the other hand, I really feel that what we teach in yeshiva is classic Torah. It's, you know, the classic sources. It's the innovation is really bringing in pastoral counseling and integrating that psychology, process groups, all of that with the sources. So it's amazing. We have a whole team headed by Dr. Michelle Friedman that really want to make sure that what the students are learning in the Shulchan Aruch or in the Talmud, they can really apply to the world and to themselves. But I wouldn't necessarily call that liberal. I think that you could be someone on the right and on the left. One of our rabbeim is a former Satmar Hasid. So it's I know sometimes we are depicted as sort of liberal on the left end of Orthodoxy, but it's really just about being honest and truthful and eager to understand the Torah with a sensitivity. There's a tremendous amount of sensitivity that starts with our Rosh HaYeshiva, Rav Dov Linzer, and the Rebbeim, and all of us. And so I guess if you associate sensitivity with being more left or liberal, then that would be so. But I think that that's the main thing. And I really feel that someone who is more right-wing, more even Haredi, can also be very sensitive. And many poskim are tremendously sensitive. In fact, the best poskim are the ones that are the most sensitive. So I think almost the term sensitive Orthodoxy is a good term rather than just liberal.
Who are your favorite poskim? Sorry, I should explain poskim are those who interpret Talmud and halacha, Jewish law, to explain it to, relate it to our lives.
So I studied for many years under Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, who passed away over 10 years ago. He was a very important poskim for me. Since his passing, I speak to his son, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. I speak to Rav Danny Landes, and I'm close to some other rabbanim. I definitely will speak to our Rosh Hashiva, Rav Dov Linzer. We also have a posek in the yeshiva, Rav Yaakov Love, who is fantastic. I will speak to him. And to tell you the truth, I draw a lot of inspiration from Rav Yashiv. There's some psakim of his that are fundamental to the idea of inclusivity and sensitivity. He has psakim rulings on reaching out to patrilineal Jews, reaching out to people who grew up Jewish who are not halachically Jewish, and some other psakim that I think are very important. And of course, since I was in Chicago, definitely I was under the influence of Gedalia Dov Schwartz, who's a very important posek, not just for Chicago, but across the country. But also, I'll tell you, I go up to frequently the Yeshiva University. It's another important yeshiva in New York.
Yes, slightly.
And when I go up, when I go up there, I always stop off in the Beit Midrash, and I always speak to Rav Hershel Schachter, who is just there all the time. And you know, these are post-scheme that I will consult with. I won't necessarily follow in a dictatorial fashion. And with Aaron Soloveitchik was very clear that the people should ask Shiloh to have post-scheme, but not necessarily a person that dictates everything you do. But I think it's so important for me and for our students also to have be part of this world of Torah.
You mentioned Jews of patrilineal descent. When you are training rabbinical students to become rabbis, the modern Orthodox world, how do you recommend they deal with the large number now of American Jews who have a Jewish father, don't have a Jewish mother, haven't gone through a conversion process?
That's a great question. I first would like people, not just our students, but everyone, to start with the principle of inclusion, of Klal Yisrael, of bringing people closer, of finding ways to include people in the Jewish community. And so certainly there will be cases where people cannot, in an Orthodox setting, get an aliyah or maybe lead their kahamazon, lead their benching. But there are many other cases of being very inclusive. I'll give one example, actually. At our table in Chicago, my wife and I would host 20, 30 people almost every meal, or at least once the Shabbos. And we had a lot of people who were either in the process of converting or people who, yeah, were not halachically Jewish because only their father was Jewish or because their mother didn't have a halachic conversion, whatever it was. We made sure to insist, and I insisted to my community, that you always have mevushal wine. You have wine that literally is cooked, but it's the type of wine that anyone can pour, a Jew or a Gentile, anyone. And I had heard stories that would be tables where people would not have mevushal wine. They'd have very kosher wine, but not mevushal. And one person, again, who was in the process of converting or wasn't halachically Jewish, would want to pour the wine. They say, no, you can't touch that because you're outside. I think it's important to use halacha, to use Jewish law, to be inclusive. And it's incredible how much the law tries to bring people in, to enable people to be part of the community and to enable people to grow and to be part of the process that is conversion. If it's not them converting, then it's their children converting. And if it's not their children converting when they're young, which I've done many times, then when they're older, when they're about B'nai Mitzvah age and they're ready to take on the mitzvot. We had a case where a woman, her great-grandfather was the Gabbai of the shul. Her grandfather is involved in the shul, but her father married someone who's not Jewish, and she, at the moment of her bat mitzvah, she converted and she took on mitzvot and she transformed her home to be kosher. You know, that's what our tradition is about, Klal Yisrael, bringing people in.
It's a beautiful statement. Let's talk about inclusion in a different area. Rabbi Weiss was famous, maybe most famous, for ordaining Sarah Hurwitz as a rabbah, not, I guess, technically a rabbi. Tell us a little bit about your position on that and what you think it means for the inclusion of women in Orthodoxy. I frankly thought that the Messiah would come long before anybody in the Orthodox movement ordained a woman, so this was miraculous for some of us. Tell me your position on this and how you see it.
Well, I think it's very important to have women leaders in the synagogue and in the community and to recognize their learning and their expertise with a title. And we have to find the title that works best for gaining the most acceptance. So, in general, I think I'm very excited about Yeshivat Maharat, which is a women's yeshiva, which is training women to do so many of the functions that rabbis do, not only halachic rulings, but really leading the community. And that is so important. And especially, I think that it would be healthy for a synagogue to both to have a male professional rabbi and a female professional. So then the only question is what title we should give. And the truth is, I'm perfectly comfortable with the title of rabbi. In Israel, Beit Hillel and other institutions have tried the title of rabbanit. And it is true that rabbanit also means the wife of a rabbi, but it means a lot more. It gives a tremendous amount of importance, and actually it has a source in the great Chidah, in one of our important Rishonim, medieval sources, who has a list of rabbaniot, that he talks about that had independent knowledge, nothing to do with her husband being a Rav. So I want to find that title that works, but I want these women to be educated, and I want them to gain leadership positions, and I want them to be part of our organizations of rabbinic leaders.
You have spoken about reaching out. Inclusive orthodoxy means not just liberal, but also conservative. That is, welcoming both left and right, for want of better terms. Tell us about the kind of, I don't know if it's a rift exactly, but the division in the Orthodox world between Haredim and modern Orthodox.
Well, I think there is unfortunately a lot of fear in many sectors of the Orthodox community, and it's a little bit surprising when you read the Pew report and it seems like the Orthodox are so ascendant and powerful and triumphant and successful, and there's still so much of a fear of the outside world. I think that what I'm really trying to do, I know that fear is expressed very much sometimes in blogs and newspaper articles. What I'm really trying to do is reach out on a personal level to leaders within the Haredi community, within the centrist Orthodox community, and just let them know that we want to be part of their world. We're not trying to run away. We're not trying to change their world. We feel it's important for our students to be part of their world, to be connected, to look to their great leaders for inspiration for halachic rulings and for Torah. So I'm continuing to reach out, and I found people have been very receptive on a personal level. On institutional levels, it's going to take a while, and it's maybe longer than I thought. But definitely I'm continuing these efforts because we have to remain a united Jewish people. We have to remain true to our principles and our values, but we also have to work extra hard, especially those of us who take these positions that we feel are very sensitive and inclusive, but can, you know, arouse fear in some segments of Orthodoxy. We have to work hard to maintain that connection.
So a final question. Our time's almost up. Very much enjoyed it. If you were to explain to the American Jewish community, people are talking about the recent Pew report and what it shows, and there's obviously a lot of difference. What do you think the most important value is today for American Jews?
I think the most important value is to value ourselves as a people, not just as a religion, not just as a culture, not just in superficial terms by kitsch, like chicken soup or Jewish humor, but really to understand that the Jewish people are a people, we're a nation, we are bound together no matter what we believe or what we practice. And I hope that people realize that and use that as a vehicle of connecting with other Jews, and also realizing the responsibility we have as Jews, as this people, to change the world and make it a better place.
Thank Rabbi Asher Lopatin for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about your yeshiva?
They can go to yct.org, or I should say, let me say this, yctorah.org.
That's better anyway.
Yes. And they should feel free to email me if they would like to at rabbi@nyc.com. So I'm very open with it, and but we're very excited about I feel the contribution that our graduates are making all over the world, and that this philosophy of openness and commitment to our religion is really making as have the impact it's having in the world.
Thank you again. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Israeli singer-songwriter and world music star David Broza, talking about his new album. It's called East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem. It was made in a studio in East Jerusalem itself, using Israeli and Palestinian musicians in a wonderful, colorful effort. It's a great story and a wonderful new recording. Our playout this morning comes from David Broza and from that album, and it's called Jerusalem. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Same face in the Gaza. It's the same face I see out in California. Same face in Jericho. It's the same face I see down in Mexico. Same face in Tel Aviv, it's the same face I see out in New Jersey.
So many places all share the same faces.